The Science Inside Podcast. This is The Science Inside with Elna.
Hello and welcome to the show. It's indeed the 1 hour of the week where we talk all things science. My name is Elna Schutz, and as always, I have a team behind the scenes. Bridget Lepere on production and Kutlwano Sahame on tech with me. And it's so nice that you today are joining me, especially if you love all things sport. There is so much happening in the sporting world at the moment. Of course, football is one of the main things that comes to mind, but so is tennis and Wimbledon, if that's more of your thing. Today, on the Science Inside, we look at sports and how nutrition can better help the human body to cope with other things that are happening inside of it. So something like pregnancy, which is a condition that takes a toll on the human body in a way, especially for someone who is a professional sports woman. And their health and performance can actually be altered and affected by pregnancy. This may not be a particularly new thought to you if you've been reading the news headlines, specifically around seven-time tennis champion Serena Williams, who recently opened up about why she has to stop or has decided to stop breastfeeding her daughter after only 6 months, because she could not seem to lose the excess weight, and instead she was gaining weight, which does happen with quite a few women. The following was an insert in of a report by Good Day America, where Williams spoke about her emotional challenge of choosing between losing weight and training for Wimbledon or staying out of the competition in favor of breastfeeding her daughter Olympia.
All over pop culture, you hear when you breastfeed, you lose weight and you're so thin. And it wasn't happening to me. I was training and everything. And everyone says, oh, you're so thin when you breastfeed. I'm going to be totally frank. No matter how much I worked out, no matter how much I did, it didn't work for me. I was vegan. I didn't eat sugar. Totally eating completely healthy. And I wasn't at the weight that I would have been had I not.
I have been doing absolutely the right thing every day, with the exception of probably the main thing, which is breastfeeding.
Literally, I lost like 10 pounds in a week. It was crazy, and I just kept dropping. What I've learned through the experience, every body is different.
So that was Serena Williams talking a little bit about her experience around being a sportswoman and how nutrition and other changes in the body can affect that. And we all know that. So often you hear advice like, oh, you should be eating this. Oh, you should be exercising like that. But these things don't happen in a vacuum. You might have a chronic illness. You might suffer of asthma or something else. And when you personally, even though you might not be Serena Williams, look at your lifestyle, your nutrition, your exercise, it all links together. So that's what we will be looking at with an expert in our main story on the Science Inside today. Then, as you know, if you are a regular listener, we have something called Unscience, which looks at some strange and interesting research. And today, if you're a left-handed person or have left-handed people in your life, there's some new research about how your brain works. That's very interesting. It turns out that the processing of emotions in your brain is not happening in the same place as for us right-handed folk. And that can have quite serious consequences on things like mental health and the treatments that work for some people, but not for others. So we'll be digging a little bit deeper into that later in the show. And then at the end of it, we'll spend some time specifically looking at multivitamins. I don't know if you take any vitamins, you pop that vitamin C, you get that little bit of like a Baraka vitamin B high when you're on exams. I am very guilty of this, but we find out, and it might surprise you, are these pills making you really as healthy as those adverts say? Or are you just making very expensive pee? We'll find out later in the show. It is all on the Science Inside. Before all of that, we'll get into the news, of course. On social media, share your stories with us. I would appreciate hearing whether you're left-handed, whether that has affected your life in some way, Also, we have a Twitter poll up about vitamins. So if you want to just pop us a vote there, we'll see and tally them up together later just to see what people are saying about whether they believe in multivitamins and how real that is to them. We're on Facebook and on Twitter as at VowFM. Just make sure you use that hashtag ScienceInside. And if you can't listen right now or you want to listen again later, the podcast is up on iTunes as always, as well as that website, which is nice and easy to remember. It's vits.journalism.co.za/science. Nice and easy, but let's get into the news after this.
This week's Science Headline.
So, as always, we get into some things that are happening in the world of science. Just grab some quick stories that are of interest for you before we settle into the rest of our show. And as always, I'm here with producer Bridget LePere. How are you doing?
I'm great. And how are you, Elna?
I'm very good. Let's jump into the news. What do you have for us?
Researchers have found that an ancient skeleton has given them clues to Southeast Asia's population and what their occupation was.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. An ancient DNA testing from an 8,000-year-old skeleton has put the controversial issue to bed. St. John's College, University of Cambridge, Professor S. Gail Willislev led an international study where skull from the Hobinhium person from the Gao Chau archaeological site in Malaysia Peninsula settled the dust over a topic which has been long quarreled for over a century. So DNA extracted from an 8,000-year-old skeleton has solved and debunked a theory about the human occupation of Southeast Asians. Apparently, Southeast Asia is one of the most genetically diverse regions in the world, and for many years, scientists have never rested the theory of whether the origins of the population in that area were correct. One theory states that the indigenous Hobinhian hunter-gatherers who populated Southeast Asia for more than 44,000 years adopted agricultural practices independently without any help from early farmers from East Asia.
Okay.
And another theory says this is a twofold account, saying that the migrating rice farmers from China replaced the indigenous Hobinhian hunter-gatherers.
Okay, so that's quite interesting, but how exactly did they find this out?
Well, academics from around the world collaborated on this new research, which was published, and they found that neither theories were completely accurate. The researchers extracted DNA from the skeletal remains from Malaysia, Thailand, the Philippines, Vietnam, Indonesia, Laos, and Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And in their study, they discovered that present-day Southeast Asian population's ancestry originates from at least four ancient populations which had previously only been successful in sequencing 4,000-year-old samples from that region. And this proved to be a scientific first. They took samples which included DNA from the Hobinhian hunter-gatherers and a Jomon from Japan, revealing a long-suspected genetic link between the two populations.
Okay, so that's really interesting that they found that genetic link, but how many skeletons did they look at exactly? Because if they only looked at one, obviously that wouldn't work.
Of course not. So they had 26 ancient human genome sequences, which were compared with modern-day DNA samples from people living in Southeast Asia today. Another phenomenal aspect about the study, though, is that the research was conducted under tremendous heat and humidity, meaning that the harsh and volatile environmental conditions for preservation, scientists were faced with many challenges because of this. Okay. So a PhD student at the Center of Geogenetics in the Natural History Museum of Denmark The University of Copenhagen, Hugh McCall, stated that sequencing 25 ancient human genomes from Southeast Asia and one from the Japanese Jomon, they were able to show that neither previous interpretation fit the complexity of Southeast Asia's history.
Okay, so that's very interesting. But why is it important for, you know, Southeast Asians in particular, but also in general?
Yeah, otherwise this study would be of no use, right? Another researcher, Professor Marta Marizon Lau, who is the director of the Duckworth Laboratory at the University of Cambridge, said the study tackles two major mysteries about the origins of the diversity of Southeast Asian people. Mm-hmm. And the ancient relationships between the distant populations such as Jomon and Haubinian hunters, looking at people who were there before farming came into play. He added that they have learned quite a lot from studying the ancient genomes, highlighting that the genome from Hausha shines some light on the importance of amazing collections such as the Duckworth, which is one of the world's largest source of human remains.
Hmm. Okay, and I'd be interested to know if there's more, more we can learn from a general evolutionary aspect here, not just in terms of this particular population, but how hunters and gatherers and agriculture evolved in the various areas on Earth.
Sure.
Very interesting. My story, just to take a little bit of a jump, comes from Associate Professor Mohammed Fad and Professor Stephen Robinson from RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia, through Science Daily. And Bridget, I don't know, do you remember that Volkswagen ad where a dad is driving around with his baby in the back and it starts crying every time the car is quiet? Here's a little clip. So that ad to me was a little bit of a hint of nostalgia, because I have so many memories of being a child and falling asleep in the car and like long trips.
Wow, I can't say I relate to that, but I've seen that happen to a lot of kids.
You never get tired in the car when you're driving?
No, I just want to be alert all the time and see how the driver is driving.
Okay, you are very good, and this study that I have for you clearly does not affect you as much as other people, perhaps. But I get it. When I'm a passenger, I definitely nod off. And it's great for kids, and it's great for an adult sitting in the back. But, of course, in driver's tiredness is a really big problem. It lowers your concentration and reaction. And some research says it's quite a significant factor in accidents. You might know that some cars have already, especially on, you know, higher level Mercedes, etc., have some vibrations that can go off, that can try to keep you awake in case you fall asleep. So it is a big issue. But here's something else. If you've had your nap and your coffee and, you know, you've done everything that you need to do, it turns out that your car may be making you sleepy on top of everything else. So it turns out that the natural vibrations of your car may be making drivers tired after just a quarter of an hour.
Wow. I've heard that before, Elna, and the usual advice is good.
I mean, it is a thing of like, don't drive tired, right? But if you are being made tired by your car, it's a very different thing. So just how much these physical vibrations of your car are affecting your body hasn't been very well understood. But the growing evidence seems to be that it is making people more tired. So the researchers that I mentioned earlier put 15 healthy and awake people in a virtual simulator that vibrates at low frequencies, the way your or my car would on a highway. And they also tested when there were different or no vibrations. So just after 15 minutes at the driving frequency, these people that they were testing were showing signs of drowsiness. And then after half an hour, there was a significant impact on how alert and concentrated someone was. And after a full hour, it got really hectic.
That's really scary, Elna. So what's supposed to happen with this knowledge?
Yeah, because it is worrying, but we also can't never drive. We can't just drive for 14 minutes, right? So the study also seemed to show that possibly different frequencies may actually do the opposite and keep people awake. So this research team is hoping that there will be more findings that can help car manufacturers build cars in a safer way at different vibrations. And that would hopefully make it possible for us to not have these kind of reactions to these vibrations, because if you think about it, there's nothing you can do about this. If your car is vibrating at a specific frequency for all of us, it doesn't matter how much caffeine you have, you're still going to get tired. So I personally got a little bit of a shock by this, but I hope that over time car manufacturers can take it into account, and hopefully this research can help not only mitigate this problem, but actually make us more awake. How cool would that be? That was just a little bit about what's happening in the general world of science, but we get closer to home and more specific after the break.
Stay curious, stay informed, stay on the Science Inside.
Hello and welcome to the show. My name is indeed Elna Schutz, and we're looking at some science inside the news at the moment. And of course, there is so much sports happening at the moment. If you are a big sports fan, or even if you're not, if you're just watching the FIFA World Cup, maybe you're watching Wimbledon, maybe you're watching both of it on two different screens. You're one of those people that has to have like soccer on the one phone and then, you know, tennis on the other. It's okay. You are welcome here, because we are going to look at it from a little bit of a scientific lens, through the lens of how sports and nutrition and our bodies interact with each other. We saw this recently with Serena Williams, specifically around her pregnancy and breastfeeding and how that affected her body and ultimately her sportsmanship. So we thought to ourselves, let's get into this, not just for the people who are high level, high performance sportsmen, men and women, but you and me who try to make it around the block without fainting. You and me who try to eat enough, you know, oranges and healthy things. What does this mean? We are speaking to Arista Nienaber, and she is a lecturer at the Northwest University Potchefstroom campus. She is a retired athlete, but also a registered dietitian with special interests in sports nutrition. And she uses therapeutic nutrition to specifically address critical care, immunonutrition, and nutrition in infectious diseases such as TB in relation to sports nutrition, which I think is really interesting because, of course, not just people who are 100% healthy and have no chronic illnesses are doing sports. All kinds of people are. So, Arista, thank you so much for joining us on The Science Inside.
Hello.
So let's kick it off. What kind of diet are sportsmen and women supposed to be on? And because there's so much to consider here: general health, muscle mass, their weight, and of course their performance.
Yes, that's true. That is actually a very difficult question to answer, because a sports diet is highly individualized, and it will really depend on the goal of the athlete. Do they want to lose weight? Do they want to maintain the weight, build muscle mass, improve performance? So, and then it will also depend on the type of exercise or sport that the athlete is partaking in. And then, as you say, also their health condition. So it is not really a blueprint diet that I can give. But I can give some basic principles on what to do. And actually, it's quite easy, because we should always rely on a healthy, balanced diet. And for this, we have always have our South African food-based dietary guidelines as a baseline that we can use. And then just the principles of healthy eating, such as eating at least 3 balanced meals per day and healthy snacks, and then having breakfast every morning, consuming sufficient protein, sufficient milk and milk products, fresh fruits and vegetables. And this is also to protect your immunity. And then with regards to sports-specific nutrition, the diet should be adjusted around the time, duration, and intensity of exercise sessions. And this is, for example, to consume sufficient carbohydrates before you go into an exercise session. And then also not forgetting about recovery, because we lots of times forget that we should recover following a training session and refill our stores. So for this, carbohydrates and proteins are really important. And research has shown that flavored milk is actually a very good recovery option to have. And this is very important within the first half an hour to an hour after a training session. And then it's also important to monitor your fluid at intake, because hydrating status also affects performance. So in summary, there are a few basic principles that I can give, but you should rather consult a registered dietitian to tailor the meal plan specifically to your needs if you are looking at nutrition and sport.
And of course it depends on the kind of exercise you're doing, as you mentioned. So somebody doing tennis is going to be different than a weight, you know, a bodybuilder or a weightlifter. But can you tell me a bit of how different a typical diet is for somebody like me, who's really just trying to make it around the block, as opposed to Serena Williams, who's training many, many hours, high intensity?
Yeah, well, that's a very big difference. For a recreational athlete, or someone that's like you, that's just going to the gym or jogging, it will be a normal diet, like a normal, healthy, balanced diet, and not really increasing the energy intake per se. But for elite athletes, we will have to increase their energy and protein intake quite a lot, depending on the type of sport that they do. And they will also incorporate sport-specific nutrition, like what do you eat, consume during a training session and after and before. While for a recreational athlete, as I say, you can actually just follow a healthy, balanced diet, and that should also be fine to reach your requirements.
So you're saying that even if I eat 5 portions of Norwegian salmon a day, it's not going to make me look like Serena Williams?
No, unfortunately not.
No, I am sad to hear that. But let's get into something so interesting that you focus on, immunonutrition, looking specifically at how nutrition relates to people with chronic illnesses or diseases. Specifically, you've looked at tuberculosis, at TB. How would your work help a sportsman or woman to heal quicker while taking their medication in order to get them ready for a major sporting event, or just in general handle both their illness and their sporting activities?
I think my research focus was more on not really sport-specific athletes that have these conditions. It's more focused on infectious diseases as such, and then also using immunonutrition in critical illness. But immunonutrition in sport is also an emerging field, so there is lots of ongoing research on that. But it's still a bit inconclusive. I think the main thing is, again, for them to follow a healthy diet. And then there's also specific immunonutrients like your omega-3 fatty acids that you find in salmon if you consume it, that may also play a specific role in immunity. And then also the timing of your intake of certain foods around training sessions that will also boost immunity. But that is really individualized, and as I say, it's still an emerging field with lots of research around it. So I can't really give you best advice on that right now.
All right. And we spoke earlier about Serena Williams and some of the stories that have been making headlines around her, specifically with her pregnancy, which I found quite interesting, how she was making decisions about her breastfeeding and nutrition. She was vegan, all these kinds of things, how that related to her sports, her sports activities. What would your advice be around the kind of training and eating plan that one would have to do around a pregnancy, whether you are Serena Williams or just the mom down the street?
I think with regards to that, it's important to start before pregnancy. So to achieve a healthy eating pattern and a healthy body weight and a good exercise program before you go into the pregnancy, because your weight prior to pregnancy and your health prior to pregnancy will also determine how much weight you can gain during pregnancy. And then also it's difficult to change your dietary habits and exercise patterns once you fall pregnant. So I think that's really important. There are different ranges of weight gain which is healthy for an underweight, a normal weight and an overweight individual. And appropriate weight gain during pregnancy will help reduce those pregnancy complications and also limit that weight retention after pregnancy. So it's really important that prior to conception. So in order to limit this excessive weight gain during pregnancy that some women find, and then that will also impact athletes or sports people when they fall pregnant, it's important to consume more nutrient-dense and less energy-dense food. So nutrient-dense means it contains lots of nutrients, including your proteins, carbohydrates, and healthy fats, and also vitamins and minerals that we sometimes forget about. But it doesn't contain that much energy in the food. And examples of such foods would be like your whole grain bread and cereals, legumes, your green and leafy vegetables, fresh fruits and vegetables, low-fat milk and milk products, and then lean meat, like fish, poultry, and then eggs. And then focus on a variety. And then you want to avoid your energy-dense foods, which will cause that excessive weight gain. And those are those nice foods that, like those that are high in fat, such as the takeaways, the deep-fried foods, and also those that are high in sugar, like the sugar, sweetened beverages, and also chocolate and sweets and things like that. And then with regards to exercise during pregnancy, you know, there are various benefits to that. But generally, the idea is to continue with the type of exercise that you are used to prior to pregnancy. So if you're an inactive individual and you want to start exercising during pregnancy, you should rather ask your doctor first. And then we want to focus on low-impact activities and then make sure that you don't overeat, so avoid excessive eat, and then stay well hydrated while you exercise.
Mm. Just lastly, Esther, I know that we've been talking throughout our conversation very much about foods and nutrition in terms of what is on your plate, but for a lot of people, nutrition and supplements also come in the form of some pills, maybe some powders. We all know that one guy in the gym who just wants to be, you know, more muscle than anything else. What role do supplements play in terms of strength, sports performance, and just your general health?
So that's a bit of a sticky subject, I think. And I also think that that should be, again, individualized according to the specific person and what they want. But they're all different, various different kind of supplements, and they have different purposes and should be prescribed in different sports. But it should be kept in mind that using supplements always comes with a risk, as supplements are not well controlled in South Africa. So the supplements that we can buy in the shops that are available is not necessarily tested. So you're not always sure if that supplement actually safe, so does it not contain any toxic substances, and then is it legal, does it not contain any ingredients that are not on the label. And then lastly, does it actually work for what we wanted to do? And does it have the ingredients in that amount in the actual product that is listed on the label? Because as I was saying, one is checking what is in our supplement in South Africa. So you can be taking something that you have no control over what you are consuming. So I think using supplements or individualized choice, and it should be governed by a professional like a doctor or a dietitian. But in saying that, there is definitely a place for supplementation in sports nutrition. And there are various studies that have shown that supplements work, but they should be used with the correct training program and then also under the correct conditions at the correct dosages. And then, as I say, you can't eliminate the risks that goes with supplementation.
Mm. Well, one strong thread coming through that conversation there is definitely there are, as always, no big shortcuts when it comes to sports or nutrition. Either you're doing it in the healthy way or you're just probably not going to get there, whether you're trying to just be your own healthy self or be the next Serena Williams. Thank you so much. We've been speaking to Arista Ninaba. She's a lecturer at Northwest University. Thanks so much for joining us on The Science Inside.
Thank you.
So just after the break, we will jump to our next topic. And this one is especially for you guys. I know you left-handed folk out there, we never talk about you enough. You might feel forgotten there in the corner with your left-handed scissor that you had to buy at some strange shop none of us know the location of. Today, we put you in the spotlight. Up next.
This is The Science Inside with Elmer.
Hello and welcome to Unscience, the 5 minutes in the middle of the show where it's all about research. And often we look at stories here, some research that seems a little bit strange. You think, why are they looking at this? Why are they focusing on this? But it usually ends up in a place where we really get something from it. So let's get into it. Today's Unscience was produced by myself and comes from Cornell University via Science Daily. Music is by Ben Sounds. I'm here, as always, with my producer, Bridget LePere. It's Unscience time.
Unusual, unlikely, Unscience.
Bridget, I happen to know that you and I are both right-handed. We are in the vast majority of people. But of course, there are some left-handed people out there. It's about 10 to 15% of the world's population. And they deserve to be spoken about also, don't you think?
Of course.
We have a right-hander's world, and there are a lot of things that you may not think about that are actually designed for right-handed people.
Yeah, so it is true the world isn't exactly made for left-handed people, from scissors to things like, look down right now, look at your jeans, look at the zipper of your jeans. Do you realize if you were left-handed, that would be the wrong way around for you? That's awkward. I've never noticed this up to today. Have you noticed this, Bridget?
No.
So I feel like the Science Society today is an ode to the people who, yeah, who just, their jeans don't open as easily as mine do. I am so sorry for you guys. But it is going to get serious, actually. So we do, of course, think of this mostly only when it comes to writing something and then everything gets smudged with your hand. Or maybe someone, you know, who kicks a ball with their left foot and confuses the other soccer team by doing that. But there's actually been quite a lot of different kinds of research into left-handedness and how it connects with other things. So one study, for instance, found a link between left-handed people and having a narrow jaw or face, which doesn't seem like a lot, but that happens to be an indicator whether you're more susceptible to tuberculosis. So
what? Just because they're left-handed?
Yep. Yeah, so there's a lot of really interesting research around this. Some of it just seems bizarre, what links there are to left-handedness, but some of them are quite serious. And it's very good that scientists are looking at this kind of thing and taking it seriously, especially in the research study that I want to tell you about, which is relatively recent. It's particularly about how our brains process emotions. So for about the last 40 years, the vast majority of research has shown that the two sides or hemispheres of our brain work on certain emotions.
Are you happy? Are you sad?
So basically, there are two sides of your brain, and certain things get processed in certain areas. So disgust and fear, for instance, on the right, and pride and anger on the left, just as an example. But here's the problem. What if all those studies were done on exclusively or almost entirely right-handed people? Because that's what has been done, of course, being the majority right-handed, you know, population. So Daniel Casasanto is an associate professor of human development and psychology at Cornell University, and he decided to do some research to see if this coincidental bias in the studies may be worth correcting, and it turned out to be a pretty big yes.
Wait a minute. So are you saying left-handed people's brains process emotions differently from us?
They don't process them differently, but they happen in a different part of the brain. Yeah. So it's not just a different part of the brain. It's the opposite way. So they base this all, let me explain it. They base it all on what they call the sword and shield theory. So imagine an old school sword fight.
I challenge you to a duel.
Most people would hold the sword in their right hand to attack and the shield in their left to protect. So these hand movements have been found to link either to approach or avoidance emotions. So fight or flight, basically. And they get processed in the other side of the brain to the hand. So sword in your right hand, but your left brain, and obviously the opposite for the shield. So Casasanto used pain-free electrical currents on healthy participants to stimulate the two hemispheres of the brain, and found that this happened just the same in left-handed people, just opposite to the right-handed people. And people without definite handedness were processing these emotions somewhere in between.
Wow, this is an interesting and fascinating piece of research, and I'm happy that there's some equality in science when it comes to all those left-handed people who may be, like my mother, be feeling left out. But is it just random, strange research?
Is it just unscience for like a funny conversation?
Yeah, does it have a purpose?
Well, actually, there's very, very serious meaning to be taken away here, which I find very interesting. So what Casasanto was doing in stimulating the brain and that process he was going through is actually very similar to something called neural therapy, which gets used on certain forms of anxiety and depression. So there, the stimulation of the left side of the brain is meant to help encourage those approach or sword emotions where they're lacking. But now, the problem is, what about left-handed people? So basically, what is happening is that these therapies are happening to left-handed people, but it's based on the wrong science. So they haven't yet studied patients that weren't healthy, but this is a pretty clear red flag that the current treatment could be doing more harm than good for some people. How scary is that, Bridget?
That's quite scary.
So I'm very glad, as weird as this research sounds, I don't know how he thought of looking at this. I'm very glad that they did find it, because that means that they can hopefully advise doctors using this type of therapy to at least stop for now, and then on left-handed people, and then hopefully develop some things around that. So it sounds quite strange at first glance, but this is one piece of unlikely and unusual research that I'm very happy somebody is doing. That's our unscience for today. If you love this story and want to tell us what you think about it, especially if you're left-handed, go find us on social media right now, VFM, on Twitter and on Facebook. And the reason I'd love you to also do that is because up next, we are talking about a surprisingly controversial subject, your multivitamins. Do you believe that they are making you healthy? Or do you think that they're just making your pee really expensive? We talk to a nutrition expert up next, but there's a Twitter poll online that you can go and vote on. Stay listening to The Science Inside.
Unusual, unlikely, unscience. You're listening to The Science Inside, bringing you science around major news events.
This is the part of the show where we like to come to some conclusions. We like to look at something that's a normal part of our lives and ask some questions. How does it work? Is it real? What is the science behind this? And today, I've got to say, this morning, like most mornings, before I leave the house, I swallow a whole handful of pills. I counted them. There were 7 this morning. There's magnesium, vitamin C, vitamin B, and multivitamins. All of them have been okayed or prescribed to me by a doctor, not because I'm sick, but because I could be healthier, I am told. Supplements and vitamins are heralded as the solution of a lot of small and big health issues. From tiredness to period pain, just pop this vitamin or that one. And of course, they are very important in our bodies. But is popping these pills really helping us? Have you ever thought about that? Are we just making very expensive urine, as some people have said? Or are we even hurting our bodies? So there's been a Twitter poll online today. Thank you for everybody who voted, asking you whether you take multivitamins, whether you think they're healthy. And I'm a little bit shocked by the results, because 50% of you said, nope, that's overkill, we don't need that. And then a third said, I do take them, but I'm skeptical about it. And only 17% of you tweeps said that multivitamins are absolutely healthy and you take them every day. I am surprised. So I'm very excited to welcome a registered dietitian, Esty van Lingen, who is the spokesperson for ADSA, the Association for Dietetics in South Africa. It's nice to welcome you to the show. We've got some big questions to get through.
Hi.
So let's just start with the basics, so we're all on the same page. Of course, each vitamin is different to the other ones. But what exactly do vitamins do in our bodies? How are they absorbed? What do they do there?
Okay. So first of all, thanks for having me on the show. So basically, vitamins help us to maintain good health. There are essential nutrients that we need in small amounts, as they perform different processes at a cellular level. And our bodies can't make vitamins just by itself. So we do need it to get it from either the food or then supplement form. And we do get 2 different kinds of vitamins. So the first group is your fat-soluble vitamins. That's the vitamin A, D, E, and K. And these ones can actually be absorbed and stored in the fat cells in the body, compared to your water-soluble vitamins, which is basically your B vitamins and C vitamins. And then these ones can't be stored, so they do need to be consumed regularly.
Okay. So they are quite important. When should we really be taking vitamins, in a supplement form as opposed to a food form? And if you've ever walked into a Clicks or Dis-Chem, you know there are thousands of them. When is it really necessary, and how do we decide?
Yes, so first I always recommend to my clients that we do need to get our diets sorted out first, because the most important thing is supplementation can't replace a bad diet. It doesn't help following an unhealthy lifestyle, eating takeaways, and then trying to just take supplements to make up for that. So first of all, we try and get them to eat a healthy, balanced diet that contain a variety of nutrients and colors as well. So these include different fruits, vegetables, whole grains, your dairy products, meat products, legumes, as well as nuts and seeds. And but we also know that due to all the processing most of our food products do go through, we don't necessarily get all the nutrients that we need or that we got compared to years ago. Or our bodies can't necessarily always absorb it due to health conditions. So the good place to start when you do suspect any deficiency or so is maybe just to talk to someone like a healthcare practitioner or a dietitian and have your diet assessed, and then make sure that you're first consuming something that you actually do need and just not take anything that you might not need. And then also when you do buy multivitamins or so, you want to get it like from a trustworthy company that is a leader in the market or so, and not just something that costs R3 for 2,000 tablets, just to make sure that at least it does contain the actual amount it says on the can, as well as that your body can actually use and absorb those.
Right. So let's get into what I already alluded to earlier, that even though I personally am a big supporter of vitamins, and many people, many doctors and dietitians are, I was very shocked by some of the research around this, and that there hasn't been as much correlation as one might want there to be. So one specific example is a recent systematic review study in the Journal of American College of Cardiology, and they found that there wasn't strong evidence for vitamins like folic acid preventing heart disease. There was no effect of multivitamins on the health of the people they tested, and even an increased risk in some cases, like with antioxidant mixtures, which I'm very shocked by. How do you react to these kinds of studies?
Yeah, so I think one of the biggest mistakes people actually make is they just consume a lot of supplements without even knowing like why they are consuming it, or even like are they consuming the right dosages or something, and then always like you saying you're consuming seven different kinds of multivitamins, but you don't always know each one's function or do you actually need all of that. And I think that's one of the biggest mistakes that people make. So they either overdose or underdose, or the combinations that they use isn't necessarily right. So I normally also recommend that before taking any vitamin, you need to talk to a healthcare provider, make sure that there is actually a need for that supplement, and then also make sure that they are aware of any chronic conditions or current supplements that you might be taking. Because if you do take different combinations of it, or say for instance herbal supplements or so within your multivitamins, and so there can be interactions, but then also with chronic conditions it can also have an effect. So you just want to make sure before starting to take any supplements that there has been research done on that, and also that you really need it, that there is a identified deficiency for that specific nutrient.
So let's try get to a final verdict of some kind if we can. As I mentioned on our Twitter poll, over half of people were either skeptical or completely against multivitamins, saying you're throwing your money down the toilet, it's not necessary. Where do you stand on it, especially for people like many of our listeners who might be young and mostly healthy? Do we really need them?
Yeah, so again, I'd definitely say to start first with your diet, make sure that you get in a variety of nutrients through the diet and that the diet is balanced. And then before starting to take any vitamins, do research on it. But by research, I don't mean just like Google, do I need to take vitamin C, or look at advertisements, or just go to a shop and talk to the salespeople, because most of those people are there to promote their products. So the most important thing is to talk to a healthcare provider that knows, or even going to see a dietitian that can actually assess your diet and make sure that you do have a deficiency or diet might be lacking in certain nutrients. And then when starting any supplement, I'd maybe say just start off with a good multivitamin so that it covers a broader spectrum compared to taking magnesium and calcium and a vitamin C and then everything else together with a multivitamin. So a multivitamin is normally a good base to start off with if you do decide. Or then also depending on if there's certain life periods that you go through, say for instance pregnancy or winter, or you need to heal from an operation or something and you might need specific wounds, or then even like sports people that do need that little bit extra and can't necessarily make their needs through the diet alone. So just start there. Or then also make sure that actual blood tests have confirmed that there is a deficiency and your current diet isn't meeting that. Then rather stick to those nutrients specifically instead of just taking one of each just because.
Okay, I'll have to relook at my handful of pills, and I'm sure a lot of listeners have either maybe started noticing things and thinking, maybe I should start something, maybe I should go see somebody about multivitamins and vitamins in general, or maybe you're taking too many. Thank you so much for speaking to us on the show.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you.
We were talking multivitamins, getting to the bottom of that. Stick with us on The Science Inside.
This is The Science Inside with Elna.
Lots of good stuff on the show today, especially quite close to home, I think, when it comes to nutrition, sports, exercising, all those things. And then lastly, multivitamins, should we be taking them or not? I have with me Anthony Teixeira, who will be doing the Sports Hub just after this. What do you think, Anthony? Are you a pro-multivitamin person or anti? Because I feel like there are two camps on the science side.
I'm not going to lie. I'm having to choke my laugh because you like fitness and sports and diet, and then you bring the fat man on to talk. Like, come on, Elna, what's going on
here? It's radio.
Yeah, for me,
nobody
though,
knows.
Well, they know because I refer to myself as the fat man quite often. So, for me, though, I feel like multivitamins do play a good role, especially more as a pick-me-up than a daily thing, in my opinion.
Right.
That's just my opinion, but you heard from the nutritionist, you know, do what you got to do.
Yeah, yeah, I get that. I mean, I have some of the pills I take are very much linked to real life things. When I stop taking them, it doesn't go well for me. So I get that, but I also understand that I might be throwing away like hundreds of rands for no good reason, which is terrible. So tell us, what's up on in the Sports Hub today?
Well, of course, we are going to wrap up the quarterfinals of the FIFA World Cup. Did you happen to catch any of the games? No, because Germany's gone home.
maybe that is correct.
Yes, because we're also going to throw forward to the semi-finals. Belgium against France, what an absolute banger. And then England, Croatia, nobody really cares about that one though. But we're going to talk about that. We're also going to discuss, you know, the French Open, because right now it's all about tennis as well. Let's not forget that there's other sports going on. And Super Rugby will wrap up this weekend as group fixtures. So we're going to throw forward to that and all the possible implications of what's going to happen there.
Exciting, exciting stuff. We are leaving you in great hands for the Sports Hub team. But from the Science Inside, a big thank you to all of our guests featured on the show today, including Arista Ninaba and Esti van Lingen, giving us some good advice there. Today, our team behind the scenes, as always, is production by Bridget Tepere and take by Kuklada Sahame. The podcast, if you missed it, wits.journalism.co.za/science. And it's on iTunes, as always, on social media. It's Vow FM. Just make sure you use that hashtag Science Inside to find us. My name is Elna Schutz. The Science Inside is produced by the Wits Radio Academy, funded in part by the South African Department of Science and Technology. As always, I will be back with you next week.
The Science Inside, Monday from 6 to 7 p.m. on OFM 88.1. The Science Inside Podcast.